The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning will be the last talk in the series of that I've been giving these last weeks on the seven factors of awakening. And today we'll be talking about the seventh, which is equanimity. It's the last in the series, and you find that the quality of equanimity, where it appears in a variety of lists in Buddhism, Buddhist lists, it always appears last. And not because it's an afterthought, but rather there's some sense that these lists have a certain kind of progression to them, and that equanimity is the crown jewel of Buddhist practice. Equanimity, the quality of equanimity, the state of equanimity, the approach of equanimity, is something that's meant to come along with as Buddhist practice is brought to maturity. And so all the other aspects of Buddhist practice, cultivation of mindfulness and ethics and all these things, are in the process of building towards a wonderful quality of equanimity. Some people, when they hear the word equanimity and hear the idea that equanimity is highly valued in Buddhism, feel a little bit suspicious, because equanimity can have associations of being aloof or indifferent, and that's not what they want. And so it seems like, oh, I don't know if I want this equanimity thing. So I'll talk about it some today. Today the topic of equanimity is in the context of the seven factors of awakening. So there's seven factors. Starts with mindfulness. There's investigation. There's effort. There is joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And these are seven faculties that we all have. We all have the faculty for mindfulness, faculty for investigation, and these different faculties. And so these are faculties that we have that get developed and strengthened in the course of doing Buddhist practice. And they're there in the service of awakening, of being awake. And I'm very fond of this word, awake, partly because of its ordinary meanings, associations with it. If you're asked to be mindful, and then later you're asked to be awake, be mindful to what's happening in the situation versus be awake to what's happening in the situation. I think there's a little different connotation, different kind of idea that comes out of that. Some people, especially if they've been doing mindfulness practice, get little kind of, when they say here, be mindful, they start kind of noting what's happening, it's just in and of itself what's happening here and that, here and there, here and here, here and now. But when you be awake, at least for me, there's some other connotations or associations with that. One of the ideas of being awake to something is to be awake is not to interfere with what is happening with the situation. Mindfulness, if you've well studied in mindfulness practice, you understand that mindfulness also doesn't interfere. But sometimes a lot of things come along with the mindfulness. Oh, when I'm mindful, I'm supposed to get concentrated. When I'm mindful, I'm supposed to be equanimous. When I'm mindful, I'm supposed to kind of be non-reactive. When I'm mindfulness, I'm supposed to notice really carefully and deeply what's here, penetrate what's going on. There's a lot of extra baggage that can come along with the idea of being mindful. Whereas the idea of being awake, I don't think comes with a lot of ideas. You're supposed to change anything, just to be kind of alert in a certain kind of clear way to what is happening. Alert attention, non-interfering attention. The idea of being awake also has the idea of, at least in my mind, a certain level of clarity about what you're paying attention to, what you're awake to. Awake also has more to do with a subjective state of how we are as opposed to what it is we're awake to. Whereas mindfulness, it's called both. Mindfulness is something how you are in relationship to things, but also mindfulness, you're paying attention to what's there. Whereas awake emphasizes more the subjective state of the mind, the quality of the mind. And that, and then also it's very interesting about mindfulness, about a wakefulness, to be awake to a situation, is that where does wakefulness exist? Where does it abide? Where do you find it? Mindfulness you can kind of find. Like, okay, I'm supposed to be mindful here. So you kind of, okay, you know, there's various things. You say it's a particular function of the mind that you can engage in. But where do you find being awake? You know, oh, where do you find that? And those of you who are ever, have been lucky enough to be really awake sometime, from nice sleep, nice nap, whatever, well, that was, you know, you've been, maybe you've been sleepy and tired and draggy for days and weeks, and then finally, well, you know, what's this? what's this? This is strange. Oh, I'm not tired. I'm awake. And so where does the awake lie? It comes along with certain qualities, and some of those qualities of awakefulness identify with the seven factors of awakening. You might not think of it that way, but there is a quality of mindfulness, of recognizing what's going on around you when you're awake. There is a quality of something like investigation. There's a more kind of clear understanding of what is happening when you're awake to the situation. To be awake to the situation, I think, and also in my mind, I associated with a certain degree of wisdom about what's happening, not just recognizing the details of what's happening. Like you go into a situation with your wits, you know, you're supposed to kind of be wise, street smarts. To go into a situation and be awake while you go in means that you're also kind of wise, perhaps, to the situation. So the investigation is the wisdom side of it. There's some kind of energy with being awake. There's a certain sense of, hopefully, well-being, the joy factor, well-being with being awake. And then there's also a degree of, I don't know, seems to me, hopefully there's a degree of tranquility, of calm, with being awake. It feels energized, but it's not restless, it's not agitated, it's not hyped up. I'm not sure to the degree to which there's concentration in being awake, but there might be. Then is there equanimity? And equanimity here is means a variety of things. One of the things it means is to have the mind non-reactive to what's happening. So the situation may be is difficult, not difficult, it's beautiful, and the mind will do some things in react in relationship to that. The most common ones is to be for and against the situation. And so the mind can very quickly get involved in a variety of activities being for and against. If it's against something, it might contract, it might feel stress, it might close down, it might lash out, it might start judging, it might start being critical, it might run away, get afraid, variety of things. If it's a pleasant thing we want to go towards, then there might be pleasure associated with that, but there might be grasping, holding on, searching out, planning for it, a variety of kind of forward kind of movements of the mind. This is, can be innocent enough, it's appropriate enough in certain situations to be for and against things, but to have the mind on automatic pilot of being for and against doesn't give the mind much freedom. And you can see that's one of the advantages of meditation practice. One of the benefits of it is you get to find out how not free you are. You know, so we can advertise. We have a big sign outside here saying, come to IMC and discover how not free you are. Suppose no one would come. But that's just the beginning. To get a see the layout, the terrain of your mind, and to discover how your mind is not so free. And so the equanimity is moving the mind towards freedom, where it doesn't react automatically to any situation at all, including the inner situations, our inner thoughts and feelings that might happen, our memories and plans and all that, doesn't pick it up and get, you know, involved in it. And so the idea of being awake, that clarity and openness, that transparency, that invisibility of kind of being awake, creates a lot of space in the mind or in awareness for experience to just abide in it, experience just move through it, experience just to be without us doing anything about it. Later we can do something about it, but initially to have that ability to let it just kind of be, the experience just to be there, to have a difficult feeling, to be afraid, and have the fear kind of be there in an awake state, or in that clarity and openness of attention, of awareness, that in the most conventional way we can call being awake. Not interfering with it, not needing to do anything about it, just there it is. Now, to be awake, as I said earlier, also points back to a little bit more the subjective side of what's happening. So we're looking at the subject. And the subject is a very interesting aspect of our lives. Because the subject, you know, you, the self, is something that you take with you everywhere you go. More or less. And more often more than less. And so it's a common denominator in all situations that you will mostly, pretty much always find yourself in. So if you find yourself in a whole series of difficult situations, where that conversation was difficult, that thing at work was difficult, that shopping experience was difficult, that driving experience was difficult, you go through the whole day with all these difficult things. And at the end of the day, you say, boy, the world just full of difficulty. That world out there. That's fine. You can do that. But what about turning around and looking at the subject who had all those difficulties? That's the one common thing, except the generic idea of the world, that terrible world. The generic thing is that, or they're not generic, sort of thing, but the common thing that went through all those things is the self, is you. So then you can ask yourself, is there something about me? About how I carried myself, how I engaged in all these different situations that contributed to the difficulty, or that made it difficult for me more than it had to be? What was the I here? The Zen master Dogen has a wonderful quote, which I'll paraphrase, teaching. He says, for the self to advance is delusion. For all things to come forth and confirm the self is awakening. So for the self to advance, for you to take, oh, here I am and I'm in charge, I want things, I don't want things, this has to be about me, and I'm going to kind of go through the world and somehow reference everything to me. That, the Zen Master Dogen says, is delusion. So how do you, what do you, so you don't, you're not just innocent until proven otherwise. You come into the world, you enter into the world with something, some attitude, some approach, some idea of self. And a big part of Buddhism is to turn around and question, what do you bring? What's the attitude that you bring? And so to understand that. And then Dogen says, what awakening is to allow all things to come forth on their own. And they tell you who you are. So rather than assuming who you are and think you know who you are, you enter into a situation and you discover yourself anew in each situation. And the idea of all things come forth suggests maybe a receptive mode of being. That here you are, you enter a situation maybe in a more receptive mode, what's here? Let's discover what's here. Let things occur and happen. As opposed to coming into a situation and involving the self, being self-directed, the self be in charge first. The self ideas, trying to prove the self or get something for oneself. So to be in this receptive mode is moving towards this idea of being awake. So, and then this interesting idea of Dogen, that you discover who you are when you allow all things to arise on their own. Now, all things doesn't just mean external to you, it also means internal to you. And so there's something about the impermanent, changing flow of phenomena and experience where we can discover ourselves. We can't hold on to it. As soon as you say, that's who I am, then you're going to advance the self. But if you're willing, moment by moment, to discover fresh, allow all things just to be there. So part of this is to question this idea of who am I? What's the attitude? What do I bring into all these different situations? And when we're awake, my suggestion is, even conventional sense of awakeness, my suggestion is that when you're awake and you notice how awake you are, awake enough to feel the wakefulness, that in the wakefulness itself, there is no self. There is no self-concept. There is no self-identity. There is no assertion of the self. Assertion of the self might be happening as well, at this parallel or simultaneously, but the wakefulness, the state of wakefulness, does not have self-assertion in it. So in order to be equanimous, it helps if we don't have a self we're asserting in this situation. And there's many, many ways of asserting a self. It doesn't mean that we become defenseless, but it means that we can become more equanimous about what's happening in the situation. So any situation happens and it arises in awareness and we can experience it, but we allow it just to be there and to kind of float and just be as it is, without being for it or against it, without pushing it away or holding on to it, without immediately judging it, that's good, that's bad. Let's discover what's here. Let's allow the situation to reveal itself, as opposed to let me immediately try to figure the situation out. So that this contributes to being more equanimous. So part of equanimity is to not be for or against. That is non-reactive attention and awareness. Another quality of equanimity, it's connected to that, but is to have a balance of mind or an even-mindedness. So there's a certain kind of strength in the mind or stability in the mind, ballast in the mind or in the heart, so that if the winds of the world blow, we're not so easily pushed around by it. We can keep our center, keep our balance. So to have this ability to stay centered is also a very important part of equanimity. And that's important to appreciate, because some people, if they hear the idea of being non-reactive and open, just allowing things to arise, can, if there is no inner core, inner stability, it can feel like, then I'm just going to be a victim of circumstances. I'm just going to be pushed around by things. But equanimity is also meant to be a form of strength. And so to have this inner core strength, where we're not so easily pushed around by things, makes it easier then to be open and awake to a situation. So these earlier six factors are the factors of awakening. Mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, are all there to support and give strength to equanimity. To try to become equanimous, because it's a good idea, and just hold yourself equanimous, I think is dangerous. I think it's better to strengthen and cultivate the heart and the mind so that equanimity becomes your equanimity becomes strengthened and becomes a resource, as opposed to, it's there, as opposed to a practice that you're going to apply and do. I hope you see the difference. So equanimity is not a practice to hold yourself equanimously, because then you're not equanimous. So what are some ways of supporting equanimity? And there's a whole series of things to support it, and these supports can be cultivated and developed. So I want to give you, so that certainly the six factors are supports, but I want to give you some other supports. And then as I go through this list, perhaps you can consider to what degree these qualities are present for you, and what degree they become a resource for you or support for you, so you can be more equanimous in different situations. So the first is confidence or faith. Do you have confidence in something? Do you have confidence in yourself? Faith in yourself? Do you have confidence in the practice of mindfulness? Faith in the Dharma, for example? Do you have confidence in that you have a path to walk or a spiritual practice to engage in? To have confidence and faith in a path or a practice can help some people become equanimous, because then they enter into very difficult situations. They know, oh, well, I have a path in this. I don't know what to do here. I don't have to find my way. This is very hard right now. But I know I can take refuge in the practice, in the path, in my spiritual life. And so that's support. If you don't have a sense of a path, it's much more easily to kind of be tossed around by things. So confidence is one. Another one is your integrity or your virtue. If you live a life of very poor integrity, stealing and lying and killing and all kinds of wonderful things like that, chances are that it's going to be hard for you to be equanimous. At least in Buddhism we teach, I hope it's true, that if you live a life of virtue, of integrity, then you can live a blameless life. A life where there's no cause to feel shamed, upset, embarrassed, guilty. You can kind of stand up and hold yourself, be upright, without being apologetic for who you are. So to be unapologetic is a way of being equanimous. And so integrity is a very important part of that. Another is to have a developed mind, a well-developed mind, or heart, if you prefer. So we have a mind which has many capacities, many, many capacities, and we could try to deal with our life with the capacity the mind is in right now. Or we can develop those capacities. I think in many avenues of life, areas of life, people know they can develop themselves. People involved in crafts, people involved in certain work, maybe all work, people involved in musical instruments, art, they spend a lot of time developing themselves, developing their capacities, developing greater concentration, greater mindfulness, greater presence, all kinds of skills that are developed. So in Buddhism, just like many of the other areas, Buddhist practice also focuses on developing the mental skills and capacities, qualities that we have. So develop the capacity for mindfulness, for investigation, for generosity, for compassion. To develop these capacities that become stronger and stronger within us. As these qualities become stronger, then they become supports for equanimity, because we have some strength to carry with us. We're not pushed around by things so much. To have a capacity to be concentrated or to be calm, you're much more likely to be equanimous if you're calm. So a big part of Buddhism, a huge part of Buddhist, traditional Buddhist training, is to train and develop these inner qualities. So looking for ways to develop them. And then another support for equanimity is to have a sense of inner well-being. Well, how do you develop that? A variety of ways. These first three ways support well-being. Another is to appreciate the value of feeling well-being, feeling happy or joyful or delighted or well-being, perhaps. I love the word well-being, to feel a sense of well-being. To take time to do those things that brings a sense of well-being. And hopefully those things are not things like winning the California lottery, but rather perhaps spending time with friends, perhaps spending time in nature, meditating, having tea. I hope that people who meditate are discovering a capacity for well-being that comes from doing less, not doing more. A capacity of well-being that comes from that kind of just letting go and just kind of opening up, shedding all the busyness of the mind, shedding the fear and the resistance in the heart, and just kind of being, just being. There's a lot of strong forces in our society that interfere with our ability to have a kind of grounded, natural sense of well-being. And so it's very important to notice what those forces are and be careful not to succumb to them. It's also important to be very careful with the forces in your own mind. And these days, there's a lot of people who are afraid with the economy. And it's, you know, it's quite understandable people would be afraid. But it's necessary to allow the fear to interfere with cultivating, developing, tapping into senses of well-being. If we're obsessed about the fear, it's very hard to feel well-being. Do we need to be obsessed? Are there other ways of dealing with our fear than having it always there? So well-being, and this is also a very important part of Buddhist spiritual life, is cultivating a sense of well-being. So underneath the advertisement outside here that says, come to IMC and discover how unfree you are, the second line would be, come to IMC and discover or improve your capacity for happiness, for well-being. Wouldn't that be nice? So, what other things? Another area of that develops equanimity is concentration. It's one of those skills we develop. It deserves its own category. To develop a stable, focused, concentrated mind is one of the really strong ballasts for the mind. If the mind is stable, calm or centered, it's much less likely to be pushed around by the things of the world. So the equanimity often follows at the heels of concentration. And in fact, in the Seven Factors of Awakening, its concentration is penultimate, and then equanimity is ultimate step. Another important area of equanimity is having insight. So the more clearly you understand what's happening, to have insight in what's happening here, the more there can be insight, more there can be easily can be equanimity. The preeminent insight, perhaps in Buddhism, is not taking things personally. Don't take things personally. And that has layers and layers of wisdom behind that statement. But to be insight means not to take it as a statement, as an understanding, but actually to see clearly that what's happening right now does not need to be taken personally. And one of the ways not to see that needs to be taken personally is to see that there's no kotuk for that hat. Many people are wearing all kinds of hats and trying to put it on their kotuk. But there is no kotuk for the hats of self. So to really see that, to turn around and see that when you really look into the mind, into the heart, for a place to hang the hat of self, if you really look, you won't find it. There's no place to hang it. Then another source of insight is to see how impermanent things are, to see things arise and pass. These insights then shade into wisdom. And wisdom is not just necessarily just insight, but having some overarching or some larger kind of understanding of what goes on in our life, what goes on in our hearts and minds, so that we can then understand it more wisely. So, for example, I find sometimes family life with small kids is difficult. I don't have much. Sometimes I don't have much equanimity. Sometimes I don't have much concentration. A variety of things I don't have. But sometimes I have some wisdom. And one of the wisdoms I have is it's just one of these days. It's just one of those days. You know, just, I don't know why it has to be this way. But it's just, the kid woke up on the wrong side of the bed. And I don't know why. We did all the things we could yesterday to have a good time as a family. And this morning, he was grouchy, sniping at his brother. So, got to deal with this, deal with it best we can. But to know, just one of those kind of, things come, they go, this is temporary, it's impermanent, is a small piece of wisdom that can help me be more balanced and equanimous in the situation. As opposed to a phenomena that occurs in my mind sometimes. I call it the delusion of permanence. Uh-oh. It's going to be this way forever. Now, I'm smart enough to know that it's not going to be there forever. But my poor little mind can operate under this delusion of permanence. The operating principle is, uh-oh, this can be this way forever. I'm always going to be grumpy. I'm always going to be depressed. I'm always going to be this way. Oh. And so wisdom reminds me, I've seen these things come and go before. These things come, they go, they're here now. I don't have to take it so personally. I don't have to be so fooled by it. I'll do the best I can. I'll try to be wise with it. And so that kind of wisdom sometimes can provide equanimity because it's less likely to react to the situation. Situation is difficult enough. It doesn't need me reacting on top of it. So, to have equanimity is a beautiful, beautiful quality. For people who have experienced strong equanimity, perhaps you can almost recognize it as an emotion in its own right. It's almost an emotional way of being, as opposed to just kind of this, it's not being aloof, it's not being indifferent. There's a association, there's a phrase in Buddhism some teaching that associates equanimity with grandmotherly love. and a grandparent's love. And the equanimity of a grandparent is comes from a lot of experience. Now, a grandparent, you know, has raised kids, right? That's, you don't be a grandparent unless you had your own kids. And so, now, in contrast that with the lack of equanimity of first-time parents, which I know very well. You know, first-time parents, every little thing is so monumentally significant. And for a grandmother, you know, the wise grandmother, loves a child. The love is there. That's why it's called grandmotherly love. But it's a love which doesn't get caught up in the drama of the moment with these kids. The kid will 1 minute say, you know, when they're younger especially, like, I don't know what, it seems like three or four age for this, they can go, like, say, I hate you. And then 5 minutes later, when I grow up, I'm going to marry you. You know, so grandmotherly love, you know. Oh, okay. 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 And then now that I've been a parent, I hope that's okay to say parent stories, but one of the things that I've learned, I didn't know that that parents did this, but I've learned to do it, these kids get hurt a lot. I didn't know how often kids got hurt. I forgot. But they get hurt a lot, these little kids. And so they're falling and then they're crying. And so what I've learned to do now is to listen to the quality of the crying. Oh, crying. Is that a cry that needs me or not? So you listen a little bit. No, I don't think that needs me. It's actually better to leave it alone. And I didn't know you could do that. I thought if someone cries, you go right away and help, right? Bad idea. You got to listen to the cry and hear what kind of cry it is. So, why am I talking about this? Examples of equanimity. I need it now. So, so I guess I was trying to say that it's the idea of grandmotherly love is the idea that the equanimity that's championed or held up in Buddhism is not indifferent or cold or dull. There's something very, it's kind of like a love. There's something very warm or beautiful coursing through us. I think of it almost as if when it's really strong, it's something that's almost physical, not just mental, and a really beautiful quality. It's beautiful. It's very, very pleasant there. There's a strong sense of well-being that comes with that equanimity. So the seven factors of awakening. So this concludes the talk on the seven factors of awakening, the series. And one of the reasons to give a series of talks like this is that the good qualities, the good factors of our mind, like the seven factors of awakening, get strengthened and fed by our appreciation of them. So if you can recognize them as they occur in your life, no matter how small it might be, if you can recognize it in its presence and appreciate its value, that actually reinforces and strengthens the capacity for those within you. If you didn't feel there was any value in them and ignored them, then they don't get fed. So I hope that you have some sense now of what these seven are, those of you who have been coming these weeks, and that you will learn to appreciate the presence when they are present. And when they're not present, I hope you're equanimous. Thank you.